So we're in the season of Lent. Lent is the 40 days leading up to Good Friday and Easter Sunday, and we're walking through this season by exploring the story of Exodus. And if you maybe remember, the story of Exodus is centered around three places or geographical spaces: Egypt, the wilderness, and the Promised Land. And we've been engaging the story, or really entering it ourselves, by asking a few questions. Are you potentially in a metaphorical Egypt right now? Is there something that you feel like is burdening you or almost enslaving you that you need to be rescued from? Or do you feel like you're walking through a wilderness right now? Or is there a promised land, a hope, or a sort of a new destination in your life that you're longing for? And we've been walking through this book, and in case you are sort of new to church, or in case you're even new to this book and you don't really remember what happens in this story, or you need a refresher on who the key characters are, take a look at this trailer.
Peace up, A-Town. Peace
up. At Pharaoh High, Ramses was the biggest player around.
No doubt.
But when the new kid in school,
I am a stranger in a strange land,
realized hanging with the in crowd wasn't so easy, he took a stand.
Man shall be ruled by law, not by the will of other men.
Moses, Moses.
Now the battle is on to see who can get the girl who will rule the school, and if a zero can become a hero. So let the games begin.
Hey!
From the creators of Must Love Jaws comes a comedy 3,000 years in the making.
You're a sharp, clawed, treacherous little...
Did you hear that?
Charlton Heston, Yul Brynner, Sinead O'Connor, and Samuel L. Jackson as Principal Firebush.
What happened here was a miracle, and I want you to acknowledge it.
10 Things I Hate About Commandments.
Okay, so that's not what the story is really about. But here's what it is about. If you were here a couple weeks ago, we were introduced to the first few chapters of the story, and we were introduced to some women who were fearless. They were brave and they were courageous in the face of Pharaoh. And remember, Moses is saved as a little baby out of the river. And the last week, we read the next section where Exodus actually skips ahead, and Moses is an adult. He's out, he leaves Egypt, he goes into the wilderness, and when he's in the wilderness, he meets with God, and God says, I want you to go back and lead the people out of Egypt. And Moses doubts himself, he doubts he can do it, he doesn't think it's going to happen, and God basically is like, I don't care, get going, you're going to do this. And Moses heads back to Egypt. And then the story continues from there. And here's what happens. We're going to look at a number of chapters today, and I'm going to summarize most of them. So we're going to look at a big chunk of this story. Here's basically what happens. Moses and Aaron's his brother, they confront Pharaoh. They say, let the people go. Pharaoh makes the work harder. He enslaves the people even more. Moses then questions God, why in the world did you ask me to do this? This isn't working out. It's not happening. God reaffirms his name to them. He says, my name is Yahweh, and remember, I told you that was my name, and that basically means I am present, or I will be present and with you, and I will, don't worry, I will rescue you and the people out of Egypt. And then there's this interesting section where we get the genealogy of Moses and Aaron. It's kind of like a little pause there in the story, and that becomes significant down the road. But then it returns to the story, and Moses and Aaron begin to confront Pharaoh, and they give Pharaoh all of these warnings, and God ultimately unleashes 10 plagues on the nation of Egypt. Now, we're going to get to the plagues in a second because they raise all kinds of questions, right? Why in the world would God be so harsh and would do that? And did these actually happen? Maybe you're here and you've got questions about even the Bible and these kind of miraculous things. Did they actually happen? So we'll discuss that in a second. But I think there's a central issue that's going on here. I think there's a central question that's at the heart of this part of the story, because when you stop and think about it, you have to ask, like, why does this string out? Why does this last so long? I mean, it could have been really easy. Couldn't God have just changed Pharaoh's mind, right? I mean, if God was in control of everything, couldn't he have just changed Pharaoh's mind? Couldn't Moses have just come to Pharaoh and said, hey, you need to let the people go? And Pharaoh says, you know what? That's a great idea. Why don't you guys just take off? And in a few days, the people leave, and it just takes a couple of verses in the story, and then we move on. I mean, that would have been so much easier, right? But that's not what happens. We have this long section of these questions and these warnings and these threats, and then God starts to unleash these plagues one after another, and it's not one, it's not two, it's not three, it's 10 plagues that take place, not over days, not even over weeks, probably over extended months, maybe the better part of a year. So we've got to ask, why does God do it this way? Why is this so important to the story? And I think there's something that's really important. I think there's a question that's raised at this point in the story, and it's a question not just for the Israelites. I think it's a question for you and me, because this isn't just interesting history, and it's not just an interesting story. Ultimately, when we gather on Sundays, we ask the questions, does this apply to our lives? What might God be saying to us as we read this story? And I think there's some questions that God is confronting Israel with, and he's confronting us with. And they're simple. The questions are, who is your God? What God do you worship? What God do you serve? Who is your God? What God do you worship and what God do you serve? And what's fascinating is for the Israelites, up until this point in the story, the God they've been worshiping and the God they've been serving is Pharaoh. That's who they've been serving and worshiping. And maybe not in the way we think about worship. They don't gather in services and sing songs and have a band and talk about Pharaoh in that sort of way. But that's not how the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible defines worship. It defines worship in a much broader and holistic way. And it actually talks about, what is the thing that rules over your life? What is the thing that you give your allegiance to? What is the thing, or who is the thing that you actually serve? And I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, but there's a word in Hebrew that plays a significant role in this story. And I want to unpack it for you this morning. It's the word abad, and there's actually three words. We'll put them on the screen. The Hebrew word, the first one is abad, and it's a verb, and it means to serve or to work or to labor or even to cultivate. This is the word that's used when God puts Adam and Eve in the garden. He says, I want you to abad the ground, cultivate, work, till, plant, work the ground. And it can even mean worship, and I'll show you how that happens in a second. Then there's the noun form of this verb. They just changed the vowels in Hebrew, and it's the word ebed. Ebed is someone who serves or who works, so that person is called a servant or a slave or maybe even a subject. And then there's another noun that you add a hey on the end, and it becomes abodah, and that means the work or the service that you perform, the service you do, the labor you do, the work you do, or even the bondage you find yourself in, the servitude or the slavery you find yourself in. And these words show up over and over and over in the book of Exodus. And Hebrew scholars, when they read this in Hebrew, when they see one word or one idea showing up over and over, it shows that that's a central theme to the story. And so let me give you a few examples of how this describes the relationship between the Israelites and Pharaoh. Chapter 1 says, the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites, and they abodded them ruthlessly. They worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with harsh abodah, harsh labor or servitude. Chapter 2, the Israelites groaned in their abodah, their slavery, and they cried out, and they cry for help because of their slavery. Abodah, right, went up to God. You're getting good at this. Chapter 5, Pharaoh, when Moses confronts him, Pharaoh basically says back to him, no, I'm not letting you go. Make the abodah, yes, all right, make the work harder for the people. And then the Hebrews say back to them, why have you treated your, no. Ebedim is the plural form of ebed. Why have you treated your servants, your slaves, the people who are doing the work, why have you treated us this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we're told to make bricks. So they see themselves as serving Pharaoh. And then, of course, Pharaoh replies back, lazy, that's what you are. Now get back to your abodah. Yeah, right, your work. And so all throughout this, what we see is the Israelites view it and Pharaoh views it this way. They are his slaves. They are his servants. He is the one whom they serve. But look at how God responds. Here's a few more verses. Chapter 3, Yahweh says, and this is, we read this last week, he's talking to Moses, I will be with you, and when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will abide. Same word. You will, but English translators have said we'll translate worship here, because that's essentially what he's saying. It could say we'll serve God on this mountain, but what God is saying is you're going to come back to this very mountain and you're going to do something here towards me. You're not going to serve Pharaoh anymore. You're going to serve me, but it's going to be an act of worship. Chapter 4, this is what Yahweh says. Moses says this the first time he confronts Pharaoh, or he's going to confront Pharaoh. Israel is my firstborn son, and I told you, let my son go so that he may serve or worship me. In chapter 6, I am Yahweh, and I will bring you, Israelites, out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves, from being servants to them. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. This idea of redeem is really, really important, because in ancient culture, if you became indebted to someone and you couldn't pay off the debt, you had to go into slavery to pay off the debt. That's how you worked off your debt. And so that's essentially what's happened to the Israelites. They're now indebted to and slaves to the Egyptians. But in ancient culture, if you had a family relative who was wealthy enough, who could come in and pay the debt for you, then they could redeem you out of your state of slavery. And so that's what God is saying. These are like my sons and daughters. And I'm going to come in and buy them out and redeem them out so they no longer have to serve Pharaoh, but so they can serve me. Goes on, and there's a whole bunch of verses on this one. Moses says over and over and over to Pharaoh, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to say to you, let my people go so that they may serve or worship me. And here's how we know that this is often means worship in this context. Later, at one of the warnings, Moses says, our livestock too must go with us. We have to use some of them in serving Yahweh, our God. Wait. You just said you want to leave. Now you're saying you want to take your cattle and your sheep and your goats with you? Yeah, because we need them, because we're going to offer sacrifices to our God, to Yahweh. That's how we're not going to worship you or serve you anymore. We're going to be worshiping. And this wouldn't have been strange in ancient Near Eastern culture. Most groups of people in most cultures offered animals as sacrifices to their gods. God would change it a little bit for the Hebrews, but it wouldn't have been strange. So they're basically saying, we don't want to worship or serve you anymore. We want to worship and serve Yahweh. And so we need to take everything with us, including these animals, because we're going to offer some of them to our God. And then in chapter 12, we'll look at this more next week, Moses says to the elders of Israel, when you enter the promised land, the land that Yahweh will give you as he promised, observe this, and the word is abodah. Observe this, and it's translated, and I think it's helpful here, ceremony. Observe a specific type of service, a worship service. A worship service where you remember how God delivered you and rescued you, and it ultimately culminated in this terrible last plague. And every single year, I want you to remember and celebrate this. I want you to gather together and remember and celebrate how God passed over you. This is the Passover ceremony that Jews to this day will continue to remember and celebrate. So you will no longer have to serve a God who's enslaved you. God is saying, I'm going to rescue you from that so you can serve and worship a God who actually loves you. After all, you're like my children. He's later going to say, you're my treasured possession. I made a commitment to your ancestors, and I'm going to keep that commitment and rescue you so you no longer have to serve Pharaoh and the gods of Egypt anymore. And this idea of who they're going to serve is going to form the foundation for all of Israel's history and existence. Because when they get to the wilderness, you remember what God does? He gives them this huge set of laws. When you get into the promised land, here's the laws, and here's how I want you to be structured society. Here's what I want you to live by. And what's the most important part of the law, the very front of the law? What is it? Ten Commandments is the right answer that nobody gave. All right, let's go back. Bible starts with Genesis? No. Some of you actually said it, though. Ten Commandments is how the law starts. And what's the very first commandment? Exodus chapter 20. Let's go to it. It says this, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt. So God always, God never gives them commandments without saying, here's who I am and here's where our relationship is first. I brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of Avodah, slavery. And here's the first thing. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not bow down to them or abad, serve or worship them. It's almost as if God knows right here at the beginning, here's the deal, guys, you're going to be tempted. You're going to be tempted to want to go back to Egypt. You're not going to remember very well. You're going to romanticize your time in Egypt. You're going to think that it actually was better back there than it is here in the wilderness, and you're not going to remember how horrible Pharaoh was, how enslaved you were. You won't remember. You're going to be tempted to go back there. Don't do that. Or when you get to the promised land, there's going to be all kinds of people that live there, Amorites and Canaanites and Perizzites and Hittites and all these different people, and they're going to have all these different idols and gods that they worship, and they're going to be cool and sparkly and new and novel, and you're going to want to worship them. You're going to be tempted, but don't do it because they will eventually dominate you and enslave you and rule over you just like Pharaoh did. So whatever you do, just serve and worship me first. Don't have any other gods beside me. Joshua, who ends up being the successor to Moses when they get in the promised land. I love this. He gets into the promised land and he finally settles all of the people. They settle in all their cities and all their towns. And then he gathers them all back together at this place called Shechem. And he says, all right, here's how we're going to live in the promised land. Let me just challenge you and push you one more time. And then this is what Joshua says. It's in Joshua 24. Now, fear Yahweh and serve him. This word shows up over and over. Serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your ancestors worshipped or served beyond the Euphrates River. He's talking about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob there, or in Egypt, and serve Yahweh. But if serving Yahweh seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods of your ancestors, who they served beyond the Euphrates, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you're living, but it's for me and my household, we will serve Yahweh. And it's as if Joshua is just pleading with the people, look, just choose to serve Yahweh. Don't serve all the other gods. And guess, look, if you get bored with serving Yahweh and you really want to serve another god, at least be honest about it. Choose who you're going to serve, because you will serve somebody. Everybody serves somebody. We are made to serve and worship something. And so you will serve and worship something. You will give your allegiance to something. So don't kid yourselves. If you don't want to give it to Yahweh, at least decide who you are going to give it to. But I highly suggest, I think he would say, that you choose Yahweh. That's who, me and my house, that's who we're going to serve and worship. Now let's pause there, because here's why I think this ancient story is so important for all of us. Because I think without even realizing it, most of us, maybe you've been a Christian just a few years, maybe you've been following Jesus most of your life, maybe you're still not even sure what you believe, but you're on a journey of faith and you're trying to figure it out. But my hunch is that most of us, even in this room, as we gather to worship God today, have chosen, without even realizing it, to serve other idols and other gods besides and before God. What other idols or gods do we serve? Maybe for you it's your work or your career, right? I'm not talking about being passionate about your work or finding meaning in your work. That's great. But some of us can turn work and careers into idols or gods that end up ruling over us, and you don't even see it. But ask your friends, or ask your family, and if they could be really honest, they might say, yeah, Number one priority for my dad is his career. He pretty much puts more time and effort and energy and thought into his career than he does us or anything else. Has that become an idol? Maybe your God is popularity, right? I mean, middle school students, high school students, that's an easy one because you want to be liked, you want friends, you want to be friends with the popular friends, and you want people to like you, right? But it's easy for that to rule over you, to become the number one thing in your life, and you don't grow out of it as high school students. Some of us still long for and are ruled by our desire for approval or fame from other people. Here's another god or idol, the pursuit of money, wealth, financial security, success. A lot of us serve that one. Because we all want bigger houses, we all want better furniture, we all want newer cars, we all want nicer gadgets, we all want better vacations than last summer, right? And we could go on and on and on, but we forget that Jesus said, you can't serve that God and this God at the same time. You really only have one master. Most of us don't even realize we've made money or the pursuit of wealth our master. Maybe your God is the mountains, right? Or maybe not the mountains, but what they represent, the pursuit of adventure or the thrill of adventure, finding a steeper ski run or a more technical 14er or a better camping spot or a more Instagrammable hike, right? And it's amazing how we can take something so good and pure, the mountains, REI, right? Something so good and pure, and turn it into an idol or a god that rules over our lives. Maybe you have a vice like gambling or pornography or drug use, and you've never thought about it as a god or an idol, but that's what it is because you serve it. Rules over you. It's enslaved you. Here's one more idol that a lot of us are ruled by. Right? And let's think about it. Most of us can't go an hour without taking our eyes off of this. Because it represents something that we're pursuing so much. We're pursuing entertainment, distraction, and convenience. And this is an avenue towards that. And we can't go a day without being controlled and ruled by this thing. I mean, if you were to ask a future anthropologist to come into our culture and look at what our lives were like in the year 2000 and what our culture was like in the year 2018 and say, what's the number one thing you noticed that changed? And they would say, without a doubt, there was this device invented that in the span of 20 years, everyone got to the point where they couldn't take their eyes off of it and they couldn't live a day without it. And if you were to ask an ancient Israelite to visit our culture and describe our relationship to our smartphones, they would say, oh, that's simple. You abhorred them. You serve them. You worship them. You think they serve you, but more often than not, they rule over you. And sometimes even enslave you. So what's your God? What's your idol? What's the thing in your life right now? For the ancient Israelites, it was Pharaoh. And it was the people of Egypt, and it was the gods of Egypt, but particularly it was Pharaoh. And you know what their situation was like? I think their situation was like a woman who finds herself in an abusive relationship with a violent man. She thought he loved him, but he doesn't. He hits her. That's not love. And he gets his kicks off of dominating her. It's a power thing for her, for him. He gets his kicks off dominating her and ruling over her. And he really has enslaved her. She would like to escape it, but she can't. Most of the time, it's almost impossible to leave that. And what she really needs is somebody to come and rescue her. Rescue her from this abusive relationship. And the issue in Exodus is not how Israel got into this abusive relationship. It's not, there's not an issue of blame or what happened here. The issue is, can anyone rescue them from their slavery? Because the truth is, the abusive husband isn't going to go down without a fight. He's not going to let her simply walk away. And so Yahweh is prepared to rescue them, and he's prepared to fight on their behalf. And that's what the 10 plagues are all about. Yahweh fighting on Israel's behalf. And we don't have time to read through all the plagues, but let me just give you a summary of what happens with them. There's 10 plagues, and they sort of grow in intensity. First, the Nile is turned to blood, and there's frogs and mosquitoes and flies, and there's sort of certain diseases, and then hail and locusts and darkness, and ultimately the last and the worst plague. And there's different, there's some interesting literary things going on in these stories. Some of the plagues are described really quickly. Some are really long. Sometimes there's warnings to Pharaoh. Sometimes there's not warnings to Pharaoh. After some of them, Pharaoh actually comes to Moses and says, would you pray to God? Would you pray to Yahweh for me, for him to relent? And Moses does it. Think about that. Moses is praying for the welfare of his enemy. He's just illustrating what Jesus would say that we should do. And after every single plague, and after every consequence of the plagues, it says that Pharaoh's heart is hardened. And what's interesting in Hebrew is the heart was not seen as the place of emotions or feelings. We often think about it that way. They would say the stomach or the gut is where your emotions or feelings were. And they would see the heart, more like we think of the mind, is where you make decisions, where you set your will, and where you strengthen your resolve. So essentially what this is saying is after every single plague, Pharaoh is strengthening his resolve to not let the people go. And most of the time it says he strengthens his own resolve. He hardens his own heart to make this firm decision to be stubborn. I'm not going to let these people go. But on a few occasions, you see near the end, it says Yahweh hardened his heart. Which is interesting. It doesn't mean that God overrode his desires. It doesn't mean that at that point Pharaoh had decided, you know what, I'm definitely letting them go. And God just came in and did a Jedi mind trick and was like, no, no, no. And forced him against what he wanted to do something different. That's not what it means. It means throughout the time that Pharaoh keeps looking at this and he keeps analyzing the situation. What should I do here? And each time he keeps deciding, no way I'm going to let them go. But a few times God whispers in his ear, you don't really want to let him go, do you? That'd be pretty soft. What kind of king lets his peasant subjects get the best of him? And of course, Pharaoh decides, yeah, not this kind of king. I am not letting that happen. But it's Pharaoh's decision. He's the one. God is just working in the background to ensure that his larger purposes are all taking place. So what are those larger purposes? What's actually going on with these 10 plagues? Well, let me give you three quick ideas and then we'll sort of wrap things up. Three perspectives on what's happening with these plagues and how they might connect to you and me. Here's the first one. The plagues are a series of natural ecological events that are later interpreted by the Israelites as acts of God. So there's a possible natural explanation for all of these plagues. Let's actually put the 10 back up there. Think about it this way. Egypt's ecosystem is unique. It's entirely dependent upon the Nile River. Even today, it's entirely dependent upon the Nile River, but especially back then. And so it's not impossible to think, as happened oftentimes, that there was a year where there was violent rainstorms in the Ethiopian highlands, which was the headwaters or the source of the Nile River. And with these violent and terrible rainstorms, flooding takes place, and it washes red clay from the Ethiopian highlands down into the Nile River Valley, which also stirs up certain microorganisms, and there's certain bacteria that have a reddish presence as well. So that would explain the color, but more importantly, it makes the water undrinkable and uninhabitable, and it poisons all of the fish. So when that happens, all the frogs, realizing it's uninhabitable, suddenly escape the Nile River and they invade all of the settlements and all of the towns nearby. But suddenly they die off because something else happens. With the polluted water and the rotting fish in the water, what often is caused is a bacteria called Bacillus anthracis, which we know as anthrax. And that would suddenly kill all of the frogs. And with rotting frogs and rotting fish, and as the floodwaters recede, there would be pools of stagnant water along the Nile River, which would be the perfect breeding ground for what? Mosquitoes and lice and flies and insects and even locusts. And mosquitoes and insects are natural carriers of anthrax. And as they bite animals, and as they bite humans, actually anthrax, we know, develops oftentimes in two different ways. It develops into livestock anthrax, which kills livestock, and it develops into human skin anthrax, which causes sores and boils on the skin. And then, in an unrelated but very unfortunate turn of events, violent thunderstorms and hail come through, and they destroy all of the barley and the crops that are just beginning to raise up. And then a swarm of locusts sweeps through, because remember the breeding conditions from before. And this is a few weeks later, and so now the wheat and the spelt that was coming up a few weeks later is now eaten and destroyed by all of the locusts. And then a sandstorm sweeps through from southern Libya, a sandstorm that would have been like the dust bowls in the 1930s in America, that would have created darkness everywhere, a darkness that Exodus describes can even be felt. And then, just when Egyptians think that they've had the worst environmental disasters they could ever face in one year, an epidemic, an infectious disease, spreads through the land, and it kills a large population of infants and children, particularly young males. Now, it doesn't fully explain all the nuances and all the details of Exodus. But Exodus isn't trying to give us a scientific or journalistic or natural explanation from all these. But it's very possible, especially if you're skeptical about sort of the supernatural, it's possible that all these things could have happened, and later generations of Israelites would look back and they would interpret this as God's sovereign hand. This is the way, and they would frame the stories that way. This is how God was actually delivering us. It's highly possible. Let me give you another way of thinking about these plagues. The second is this: it was Yahweh's demonstration that he is the powerful God over creation. You see, everything we're told in Genesis about God and how he creates the world is actually echoed here in Exodus, but with a twist. In Genesis, the garden is the place where waters of life flow from the rivers. In Exodus, the Nile is turned into a river of death. In Genesis, creatures of the sea and winged creatures of the air multiply and carry life. In Exodus, frogs and mosquitoes and flies and locusts multiply but become carriers of death. In Genesis, cattle and sheep and goats and livestock are given to humans to serve them and to help them. In Exodus, they all die of disease. In Genesis, the vegetation provides food for animals and humans to eat. In Exodus, all the vegetation is destroyed by hail and by locusts. In Genesis, the skies and the weather are favorable and they give light. In Exodus, they're violent and destructive and they bring darkness. And finally, the creation accounts in Genesis, they're all about life, and they're all about giving human beings stewardship of life. And in the final, most terrible plague, God brings death, and he takes away that stewardship from humans. You see, in Genesis, God creates natural order from chaos, for the flourishing of human life. And in Exodus, God allows the natural order to descend back into chaos, to demonstrate and to teach the Israelites that he's not just a tribal God, and he's not a local God, and he's not just the God that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob worship. He is the God over all creation. Maybe that's what God was doing. But here's one final perspective that I want to give you, and it's not exclusive to the other two. It's possible that they all build on one another, but I think this is the most important one for our purposes. The plagues are God's judgment. Yahweh's judgment on Pharaoh and the gods and the people of Egypt. You see, the people of Egypt and Pharaoh have enslaved his beloved people. They've taken advantage of them. They've judged and they've subjugated them to slavery and they've treated them harshly. And now God is judging them. He's letting them pay the consequences of what they've chosen to do. And he's just using nature to do it. And so the people of Egypt suffer, and so do their gods. The Egyptians worshiped a pantheon of gods, and I won't go through all of them, but it's almost as if in every single plague, God is judging the gods of Egypt. There was a god called Hapi. He was the Nile River god, and it's like God is turning the Nile into blood to judge that god. There was a god called Amun-Ra that they would worship as the sun god, and God blots him out with the darkness. There was a god named Men who was the god of fertility and vegetation. And every year during harvest time, they would gather and have this lavish celebration to celebrate all the things that Men had done to bring vegetation and harvest to the people. And it's like God is just making a mockery of that with locusts and with hail. There's even a god named Heket that was represented as a frog that they worshiped. And it's almost as if God is saying, hey, you worship frogs, you got them. Here they are. Here's your frogs for you. And I could go on and on and on, but it's as if God is challenging and exerting his power over all the gods of Egypt, but particularly over Pharaoh. Because Pharaoh is the divine being that they worshiped, is the one that's at the center of this story. And so God's going to let Pharaoh keep resisting. And God's going to let Pharaoh keep being stubborn. And God's going to let Pharaoh keep fighting so that he can fight Pharaoh back. And so that he can show and he can let the people. And people are going to suffer after plague, after plague, after plague. But there will be no mistaking and there will be no confusion by the end that Yahweh is the God of power. And that Yahweh truly loves his people. And that he will do whatever it takes to rescue them from the abusive husband or the one who's enslaved them. After all, this is what God says after the last and final terrible plague in Exodus 12. He says, I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt for what they've done to my people, basically, because I am Yahweh. So what do we take away from this? Well, let me tell you one thing we shouldn't take away. We shouldn't take away that any particular natural disaster is God's hand of judgment. That's not what this passage is teaching us. This was a specific instance and a specific time in the history of the nation of Israel, and that would be drawing implications that aren't actually there. But here's what I do think we should take away. We should take away that God wants us to serve him and only him. Because he knows all the other gods that we're tempted to serve will enslave us. He knows that when we're tempted to make our work or our careers into an idol, it will become enslaving. And it will destroy our lives. He knows that when we serve the god of the pursuit of success or wealth or adventure or popularity or convenience or distraction or entertainment or whatever it is, that those gods enslave us and they abuse us. And they will rule over us with us not even realizing it. And he wants to rescue us from that. And he'll do whatever it takes. He will fight for us. So much so that for the Egyptians, it resulted in the death of their firstborn son. And so much so that for all of humanity, it resulted in the death of God's one and only son. That's what he was willing to do, to fight for all of us, to redeem us and buy us back and out of slavery so that we don't have to serve gods who will abuse us. We can serve a God who actually loves us. So what God do you serve? What idols maybe exist in your life right now that you need to consider letting go of or leaving behind? Let me pray for us. God, this is a powerful story, and we don't want to deny the reality of what it portrays. But we also recognize that it can be our story. And for many of us, it has been. It represents our redemption, our rescue from you. For some of us, that felt very miraculous that you would reach down and save us in a really horrible time in our lives. For others, maybe it wasn't so miraculous on the outside, but it was miraculous nonetheless. That you loved us and you want to rescue us from our sin and from the slavery that it brings us into. And so God, help us to examine our lives right now and be willing to take those things that we've made idols and to let go of them. During the season of Lent, to be willing to say, I need to give those things up. God, give us the courage to do that. Pray this in your name. Amen.